नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th Canto, Chapter 16. Lord Parashurama destroys the ruling class. Text 24. And we may do 25 and a couple of others because they have no purports. Swadeham Jamadagnistu. Labdwa Sangyana Lakshanam Rishina Mandale Subhut Saptamo Rama Pujataha Swadeham, his own body. Jamadagni, the great sage Jamadagni. Tu Labdwa, regaining. Sangyana Lakshanam, showing full symptoms of life, knowledge and remembrance. Rishinam, of the great rishis. Mandale, in the group of seven stars. Sa, he, Jamadagni. Abhut, later became. Saptama, the seventh. Rama Pujita, because of being worshipped by Lord Parashurama. Translation. Thus, Jamadagni, being worshipped by Lord Parashurama, was brought back to life with full remembrance, and he became one of the seven sages in the group of seven stars. Purport. The seven stars revolving around the pole star at the zenith are called Saptarshi Mandala. Of these seven stars, which form the topmost part of our planetary system, reside seven sages: Kashyapa, Atri, Vasishta, Vishvamitra, Gautama, Jamadagni, and Bharadvaja. These seven stars are seen every night, and they each make a complete orbit around the pole star within 24 hours. Along with these seven stars, all the other stars also orbit from east to west. The upper portion of the universe is called the north, and the lower portion is called the south. Even in our ordinary dealings, while studying a map, we regard the upper portion of the map as north. Text 25. My dear King, preach it. In the next Manvantara, the lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, Lord Parashurama, the son of Jamadagni, will be a great propounder of Vedic knowledge. In other words, he will be one of the seven sages. 26. Lord Parashurama still lives as an intelligent Brahmana in the mountainous country known as Mahendra. Completely satisfied, having given up all the weapons of a Kshatriya, he is always worshipped, adored, and offered prayers for his exalted character and activities by such celestial beings as the Siddhas, Charanas, and Gandharvas. 27. In this way, the Supreme Soul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Lord and the Supreme Controller, descended as an incarnation in the Bhrigu dynasty and released the universe from the burden of undesirable kings by killing them many times. Om agana chimarandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshun militang yena tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. As always, Srimad Bhagavatam is giving you information about things within your experience, things beyond your experience, and things that contradict your experience. An open-minded person will easily accept that, although I have my experience and I've observed various regularities in my experience, still there can be exceptions, and certainly there can be occurrences and phenomena beyond my experience. A fanatically closed-minded person will insist, this is what is. We have experienced. These are the regular patterns of nature, and that's all that there is. Whether you are a theist, an atheist, or you are just confused, agnostic, whatever, you still are dealing with the issue of the ultimate fact. Srimad Bhagavatam presents Janmadhyasata, that ultimate fact, that supreme absolute truth, is where from everything, who from everything emanates. Denying that, you can put your faith in matter. That matter does inconceivable things. Even one of the most lauded scientists of the 20th century very brilliantly puts forth what he considers fact, that the universe appears out of spontaneous creation. By some adjustment of mass and energy and the laws of nature, the universe appears. He's still accepting an ultimate fact. Whether you call it the universe, mass energy, or the laws of nature, you have accepted an ultimate fact. And we accept an ultimate fact as Swayam Bhagavan, not only the source of all energies, but the source of all avatars, planetary expansions. How can you say that the laws of nature bring things into being? Sometimes people do say that. It's just because of the laws of nature, the universe has emerged as it is. Conscious entities have emerged. But what they are mistakenly doing, among many other things, is ascribing causal power, ascribing agency to laws. Laws do not cause anything to happen. Laws are simply observations of patterns in nature. So therefore, people call them the laws of nature, based on, again, patterns they've observed. But how do you go from assuming those laws of nature are correct everywhere, which is a huge assumption, assuming that the laws of nature, as currently known, are prevalent everywhere throughout all portions of the universe, then tell us, how do laws cause anything to happen? But you'd be shocked how many persons become fooled by such word jugglery. The laws of nature have brought this into being. Because of the laws of nature, the universe has spontaneously generated. We say, Janmadhyasata, Sarva Karna Karna. The ultimate cause is a supreme conscious person. You want to deny that? So then what is your ultimate fact? Your ultimate fact becomes matter, as Prabhupada explains in Adi Lila Chaitanya Charitamrita. You invest into matter inconceivable potencies, achincha shakti. Or you say the laws of nature, or mass or energy, still you are trapped with an ultimate fact. This verse today is talking about the Saptarishi, the seven sages. Where do I get that kind of information from, that there are seven planets upon which seven sages reside? But just consider what you've already heard in this chapter. In Christianity, there are arguments between very liberal Christians, very conservative Christians, and, of course, non-believers. Is the resurrection a fact, or is it just symbolism? This chapter has given you so many resurrections. Jamadagni, Renuka, Parashuram's brothers. They all met their deaths, but through mystic power, they came back to life in the same body. So what is a miracle for one set of people is commonplace occurrence for others. Of course, as His Holiness Prahlada Maharaj explained yesterday, you're dealing with, in this history of Parashuram, you're dealing with another time in which such powers occurred. And of course, you're dealing with Parashuram, who is a Shaktivesh avatar. He's invested with a particular potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just as the Kumaras, the four Kumaras, are invested with the potency of knowledge, Narada Muni with bhakti, those are other Shaktivesh avatars, as you know. Prithu, the power to rule. So Parashuram was invested with the power of destroying demoniac leaders, demoniac administrators. Even though he's born in a Brahmana family, his mission took on the behavior of a Kshatriya. But you'll hear that at the end of that particular leela, because Parashuram is described amongst the Leela avatars also by Rupa Goswami in his Lagu Bhagavatamrita. In text 26, completely satisfied, having given up all the weapons of a Kshatriya, he is always worshipped and adored and offered prayers for his exalted character and activities by such celestial beings as the Siddhas, Charanas, and Gandharvas. What are you going to do about Srimad Bhagavatam? There is always something beyond the range of your senses mentioned everywhere. Jamadagni, having his head joined to his body by Parashuram, Jamadagni bringing Renuka, his wife, and his sons back to life, and Parashuram being worshipped by celestial beings as Siddhas, Charanas, and Gandharvas. We accept Srimad Bhagavatam on the basis of authority. As Srila Prabhupada once explained, there cannot be any progress for human society without the acceptance of authoritative knowledge. Authoritative knowledge means coming from an authority. So if you want to judge the knowledge, you have to judge the authority. But you'd be surprised how alien that point is these days. Well, knowledge just appears on its own, or everyone has their own knowledge. No, genuine knowledge comes from an authoritative person. If you want to judge the knowledge, first judge the person that speaks the knowledge. So this is Srimad Bhagavatam. We're taking knowledge from the greatest authorities, Shukadeva Goswami and others. Yesterday you were discussing the point about, does Lord Parashuram need to purify himself? What does Krishna explain in Bhagavad Gita? Namam karmani limpanti, name karma palesbriha. The effects of my... there are no material effects to what I do, Krishna says. Nor do I aspire for any material goals. Yet I'm still active, I'm still doing things. All for the benefit of the living entities. This morning I was thinking of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his attempt to go to Vrindavan. As you know, he came back. Upon his return to Puri, he explained to his followers, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and others, I tried to go to Vrindavan. I wanted to go through Bengal so I could see my mother and the Ganga. But there were thousands of people following me, destroying the boundary walls, destroying the grounds surrounding where I would stay. How could I go to Vrindavan like that? And Sanatana Goswami brought out the point to him that Vrindavan is Durgama, very difficult to attain. It's insurmountable. Vrindavan is Durlabha, rarely achieved. It's meant for Nirjana, a solitary approach. So Mahaprabhu took those words very seriously as he was explaining to his associates in Puri. I was going to Vrindavan like a magician surrounded by a huge entourage. That's not the way. So I came back. But the main reason I came back was because of Gadadhar Pandit. He was so disturbed that I left. When Gadadhar Pandit heard this, he clasped the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and said, wherever you are, that is Vrindavan. Wherever you are, that is the Yamuna, the Ganga. Wherever you are, that is where all holy places reside. You don't need to go to Vrindavan, but still you do it to set an example for the ordinary people. Mahaprabhu himself testified during the Ratha Yatra, Moramana Vrindavana. My mind is Vrindavan, Mahaprabhu said, because in my mind, the pastimes of Radha and Krishna are constantly taking place. So Gadadhar Pandit reminded Mahaprabhu of that. You're going just to set the example for others. Srila Prabhupada makes a very essential point for us in discussing this part of Gaura Lila. He says that in Vrindavan there's so many persons attached to Radha and Krishna and trying to enter into Radha Krishna Lila. But this is very difficult. But if you approach Radha and Krishna through Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then it is possible. So as you well know, Srila Prabhupada said, this is one reason why we've established the Krishna Balaram Mandir, to show everyone Krishna Balaram are the same as Gaura Nithai. You approach Radha and Krishna through Sri Sri Gaura Nithai, and then the access is possible. So many eternal Brajbasis didn't physically go to Vrindavan. A long list is given in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Srup Damodar, Haridas Thakur, Gadadhar Pandit, Shiki Mahiti. A list of about 10 persons. But still, they're eternal Brajbasis. So Gadadhar Pandit's point is very important. You're going, you're attempting to go, if we would let you, you're attempting to go to Vrindavan to set an example for others. Then he presented to Mahaprabhu, no one can tell you what to do, no one can order you around, but the rainy season had just started, why don't you stay 4 months and then try again to go to Vrindavan? Obviously, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu does not need to go to any holy place in order to purify himself. But again, to set the example, Parashuram doesn't have to perform austerities and go to holy places to purify himself after slaying 21 generations of Kshatriyas, one generation after another. But he does so in order to set an example. There's pretext in what he does. He took the excuse of the murder of Jamadagni and the grief of his mother, Renuka. He took that pretext in order to do what he came to do, finish off 21 generations of Kshatriyas. So the real reason is not to avenge Jamadagni's death and his mother's grief. That's just an excuse. The real reason is that the administrators, the leaders of human society, have become so deviant. We may wonder, well, that was then. Now, things aren't that bad. Things are just as bad or worse. We allow our leaders to spend trillions of dollars on nuclear armaments. And we don't object. We don't accept that such an extraordinary military buildup is demoniac, as Srila Prabhupada explains. It's a total misuse of energy. We're assured we have to have these weapons in order to protect our nation, in order to protect freedom. Meanwhile, people are completely enslaved, paying for these weapons, trillions of dollars. In the U.S., they're spending over $1 trillion just to renovate the nuclear arsenal. Just renovation, upgrade, version 3.4, $1.3 trillion. You can't conceive of how much money that is. The Vaishnavacharyas see this as a complete perversion of the human form of life. We just take it as normal. So many nations have nuclear weapons these days. You ask the people, what will the people say? We need those weapons to protect the nation. And the scientists promise you that spend millions on these weapons and we guarantee the weapons will never be used. Is it a money back guarantee? Has there ever been a weapon that hasn't been fully utilized? I was explaining in Mayapur how just one nuclear-armed submarine, in the U.S. Navy they call them boomers, just one submarine has nuclear havoc on it 2,000 times more than the bombs dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki. Just one submarine, 2,000 times more. And this is all for peace and prosperity, remember. So what you're reading about Jamadagni and how he took action against the unnecessary pride and strength of the Kshatriyas, devoid of any Brahmana guidance, What you see then is going on now. And you can be sure, this way or that way, there'll be a catastrophic response. Nature is doing it. The human beings are destroying themselves. So on a pretext of avenging Jamadagni's death, Parashuram finished off 21 generations of Kshatriyas. Pretext happens in Krishna Leela. Remember Yudhisthira Maharaj presenting the need for the Rajasuya Yajna to Krishna? He said, personally, we Pandavas don't need all this pageantry. We don't need this gala, massive yajna. We're satisfied just with your personal association. But we want to do this yajna and call all the devas. We'll satisfy them by showing that you, Krishna, are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We want to demonstrate to everyone the difference between accepting you, Krishna, as just an ordinary person and as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, cause of all causes. We want everyone to see this. But again, for us, we have no need of this. Remember Lord Balaram, after dispatching Romaharshana Sutta. The acharyas point out that Balaram, with that blade of kusha grass, did it quickly before the sages could protest. He knows how to terminate. The sages did protest a little afterwards, but Balaram was quick, and who would expect that with a blade of kusha grass, someone would die? So Balaram quickly did it. And then the sages cried out, oh, alas, alas, you have acted in a way that's adharma. So the acharyas point out what they were really saying. By accusing Balaram of being adharma, adharmic, they're actually saying, what is dharma and what is not dharma doesn't apply to you because you're far beyond that. So Balaram, setting the example for ordinary people, said, all right, what should I do to atone? I can bring him back to life if that's what you want. But this Brahmin said, no, 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 no. You should kindly preserve our benediction that we gave him, that he would have long duration of life and sensual strength, sensory strength, and that he would be able to expound. Is there some way that that benediction could be intact while at the same time honoring your killing him? Balaram, as you know, came up with the solution. The father lives through his son. Call Ugrasrava, the son, and the son will continue with the benedictions that you gave to the father. As for me, Balaram said, what do I do? Balaram presented himself as not knowing. How do I atone? I've done something that I need to counteract. Tell me how to do some pious activities. This is Lord Balaram. So they told him. First, explaining, you have no need to do any kind of atonement, but please, for the sake of the people, do the pretext of atonement for the sake of others. So they gave Balaram an assignment. Just like our sannyas minister here, when there are applicants for sannyas, they get assignments. So Balaram submitted himself to the brahmanas. Give me an assignment. Okay, number one, Bovala, this hideous demon who pollutes in such an abominable way our sacrifices. Number two, take a tour of all the holy places in Bart for 1 year. As if Lord Balaram needs to do that, but Lord Balaram did. Then you have the occasion of Samanta Panchak itself. This is where Lord Parashuram created five lakes because he killed so many Kshatriyas. Their blood formed five lakes. Panchak means five. Five lakes, Samanta, big, pervading. Besides the place where the blood gathered in five lakes, it's also the place where Lord Parashuram did his atonement. He doesn't need to. It's a pretext, but just to set the example for the ordinary persons. Then, at the time of the solar eclipse in Krishna Lila, not an ordinary solar eclipse. It's explained that this particular solar eclipse was massive, like something that occurs at the end of a day of Brahma. What happened? People from all over Bharat came to Samanta Panchak seeking the credit of Punya. And the Yadu dynasty also went. And as you know, the Brijbasis came too. For the Yadu dynasty, they were just taking the pretext of needing to accumulate pious activities. Their real reason was to associate with Krishna, to see their relatives, and of course, the residents of Vrindavan were also coming. So again, you see how Vaishnavas are opportunistic. Srila Prabhupada once explained that this is a characteristic of a Vaishnava. Opportunism. You know how to seize an opportunity for hearing and chanting about Krishna, for serving Krishna. You see how the world's becoming crazier and crazier. Instead of becoming depressed, what does a Vaishnava think? This is a greater opportunity than ever before to get the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The more people are sinful, the more mercy there is for those devotees who try to spread the glories of Krishna. This is opportunism. There was an expression in the 60s, seize the time. It was a political expression. If you're a person who understands the political situation, seize the time and do something about it. Well, Vaishnavas are always seizing the time. Particularly those in the line of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, Srila Prabhupada. We're looking for opportunities. Sizing them up. How can Krishna consciousness be spread in this particular setting, in this particular time? So the Yadus seize the time. So, full eclipse, let's go. We'll go to Samanta Panchak. Such a gathering it was. And such Vaishnava relationships. Again, as you heard yesterday, in class given by His Holiness Prananda Swami. Such loving exchanges. The Yadus greeting other kings. The men were embracing, their hairs were standing on end. Their bodies were shivering, tears were pouring from their eyes. And sooner or later, all their talks would end up being about Krishna. If the men were that dramatic in their greeting of each other, you can't imagine what the ladies were like. The Bhagavatam describes that the ladies embraced each other so tightly they were crushing their chests. So intense was their meeting. And then the eternal residents of Vrindavan show up. Vasudeva and Nanda see each other. Devaki and Rohini see Mother Yashoda. They see Krishna and Balaram on the lap of Mother Yashoda. One acharya explains a technical point, that when Krishna was on the lap of Mother Yashoda, he changed into a child form. In any case, he's always Mother Yashoda's darling son. That's how she sees it. While she's cuddling Krishna and Balaram, Devaki and Rohini are watching. They're watching this whole scene and they're concluding. Look at Krishna and Balaram. They're showing more affection for Yashoda than for us, the real mothers. And look at Mother Yashoda. She has so much more affection for Krishna and Balaram, our children, than we ourselves do. Devaki and Rohini seek to inject some reality into the situation as they see it. They pointed out, they said to Mother Yashoda, "Oh, how glorious you are. Even though these two children are not really yours, still you've protected them so much, like the eyelid protects the eye." This was a subtle way of, excuse me, but these are actually our boys. But Mother Yashoda was so much absorbed in her Vatsalya praying, she didn't hear it. So Devaki and Rohini conclude, "What's the use? Let's go outside and talk to Kunti and Draupadi." And then, of course, it's time for Krishna to meet the gopis. And he did so in a secluded place. Balaram saw what was happening and he exited. He didn't want to be there when Krishna is having his exchanges with his dearmost devotees. So remember, all this huge gathering, by the way, one acharya points out that the cowherd boys were not there. They were back in Vrindavan because they had been satisfied by Uddhava's instruction. But the older cowherd men, the older gopis and the young gopis were there. Technical point. In any case, the whole extraordinary arrangement is happening for the Yadus, for the Brijbasis, based on a pretext. Let's go to Samantapanchak, the lakes caused by Lord Parashuram's slaying of 21 generations of Kshatriyas. Let's go there because of the need for pious activity and to counteract any negative effects of the massive solar eclipse. Pretext, which sets an example for ordinary persons. But meanwhile, there's so much else going on. So here you have concluded the section of chapter 16 about Lord Parashuram. And you're moving into the description of Vishwamitra Muni. Any questions, comments from our seniors?
as you mentioned, like in case Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said Vrindavan is Durgam, very difficult to achieve. Even he told Jagannath not to stay longer here. Jagannath Pandit, he told not to stay longer. Many other Mahaprabhus also said couldn't come to Vrindavan. So now we see on the contrary now, at present, so it has become Sugam. Sugam is very easy to make. But the pilgrims, those who visit Vrindavan, they don't know the purpose of visiting Vrindavan. How to understand this phenomenon?
As you know, there are various degrees of entry into the real Vrindavan. Someone may come as a tourist, not knowing anything. They will certainly get benefit, but it won't be the same benefit as someone who follows the instructions, for example, of Narottam Das Thakur, how to get the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, the six Goswamis. Then one can understand Vrindavan. So there are different levels, different degrees of intensity. Just like, for example, Srila Prabhupada's building this temple. He said he wanted a place where his disciples could worship Krishna in Vrindavan. He wanted us to take advantage of this facility. And he wanted so many people to come and take advantage. But obviously, yayata mam prapajyate, tams tataiva bhajamya. They're at different levels in their approach to Krishna and they'll get different results. Who knows, maybe in your past life, you were one of those persons coming from Delhi just... Anything else? Yes.
Thank you very much. Very, very deep and nice. I was reading through this passage, through this chapter, because they asked me to give class day after tomorrow. And I saw that, the extermination of all these children of Kartavirya Arjuna, I couldn't understand why Parashuram killed all the kids, all his sons, the children, but he didn't kill Kartavirya Arjuna, he left him alive. Because he wasn't dead. Like sometimes you say you got the head of the snake.
Didn't Kartavirya Arjuna get it also? In an extraordinary way?
Yeah. He got killed first.
Oh, he was killed. It was mentioned in the beginning.
Yeah, he got killed first, and then his sons killed Damodarani, and then Parashuram killed all the sons.
Okay.
Sorry. Never considered asking about that.
Yes.
Hare Krishna. Well, you mentioned about the solar eclipse and Samant Panchakam. When I read these statements that a certain place gives so much benefit, a certain constellation, situation, positioning of planets give certain kind of benefit. Who decides this? But just like some prayers, if you recite, then the benediction of the writer, he has to be a powerful person, is there that you get some benefit, like in the Guru Ashram prayers. And then just like this eclipse, who decides that it is inauspicious? How do you get this understanding? And someone depends on it.
Who decides?
Yeah, what is the rule behind? What is the law behind that?
Didn't we say at the beginning of class, the materialistic idea is that laws of nature just exist by themselves and they cause things to happen, which is totally illogical. whenever there is any kind of phenomena, there's always a conscious entity behind it. That's the Bhagavatam's axiomatic fundamental principle. There's always a person with a person's will and desire behind everything. So remember, as soon as you start talking about laws, as Prabhupada would say so many times on morning walks, what about the lawmaker? But people are so bewildered these days, they hear about the laws of nature, like the law of gravity. Number one, they assume that those so-called laws cover every part of the universe, although they haven't experienced every part of the universe. And number two, they think implicitly that laws have agency, causal power, which of course is totally fallacious. So whether it's the law of gravity or the benefit one gets by going to Kurukshetra, Samantapanchak's a part of Kurukshetra, the benefit one gets, all this is set in motion by personage, by consciousness, by personhood. That is the general understanding.
So can you explain that who decided that by taking bath in these fake fire lakes?
I already answered your question. Some person. Anything else?
If you remember from the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says not a blade of grass can move nothing. So the sanctioning comes from Krishna. So there's no more authority than him.
There, you've heard it. Yes, Maharaj.
You a little bit more technical aspect. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, under the influence of time, the three modes of material nature are providing us with karma. So every living entity in the material universe is a manifestation of Krishna's, well, we could say his energies, of which the demigods are also a manifestation of his energies. And under the influence of Krishna's in the form of time, the three modes of material nature in the form of the demigods are arranging themselves to provide karma that the living entities deserve. So that's more or less how it works.
You can look at the situation from another angle also. What the Vedas are presenting, the Vedic knowledge presents the universe as a hierarchy of consciousness. A hierarchy of nested consciousness. There is the consciousness possessed by lower living entities, and then more pervasive is the consciousness possessed by human beings. More pervasive than that is the consciousness possessed by demigods. Ultimately, the all-pervading omniscient consciousness is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So you have a nested hierarchy of consciousness. All right. Is that fancy enough sounding for you?
So, how do you respond sometimes when people say that all these narrations, these are just mythology? Even sometimes you will find out what is, well, I've written this for a long time, you also start doubting these narrations.
Again, who decides what is a story, what is mythology, and what is not? Without relying on an authority, everything is unknown for you. So we're really dealing with a battle about who are reliable authorities. Otherwise, how will you distinguish between what is myth and what is not myth? There's so much going on beyond the range of your sense perception. You're hearing today the Saptarishi Mandala, the seven stars revolving around the pole star, each one having a particular sage residing there. Now what are you going to do? Say yes, no, maybe so? When I'm speaking at universities, I often explain to students, I said, look, you don't understand how your own political system is working. You don't understand how your own financial system in your land is working. And they admit, oh, that's true. Do you understand Wall Street and all? Do you understand the Pentagon? Do you understand what's going on in Delhi? Do you know what your own chief minister is doing? So how dare you comment on Srimad Bhagavatam? But if you want to know the truth, then you have to enter the bhakti laboratory. Otherwise, who are you to so proudly say, this is myth, this is not myth? Just like I explained, there's a big battle within Christianity between the very liberal ones and the very conservative ones. The conservative ones say the resurrection is a fact. The very liberal ones say it's a myth meant to imbue us with devotion. And of course, atheists say, who can believe there's a resurrection? But how many resurrections have you experienced in this chapter? Renuka, her sons, Jamadagni. So what's a miracle or a myth for one person is fact for someone else. Everything comes down to who is your authority. Knowledge must be authoritative. What you call a scientific fact generally changes every 100 years, if not quicker. So we take advantage of the authorized knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam and make spiritual advancement. That means detachment from matter and attachment to Krishna. That shows that you're in touch with authentic knowledge. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.